Hello, and welcome to episode 236 of the Awesome Comics Podcast, the place where the small press makes one hell of a big noise. I'm Vince Hunt, creator of Indigo Park, and joining me this week are the creator of Vanguard, Dan Butcher.
Hello.
And writer, artist, and the ringer in everyone's pub quiz team, it's Tony Esmond.
Bonjour. We're still buzzing.
Yeah, we just had a fantastic time. I basically just sat back and listened. I thought it was great.
Yes, this week we have a guest. It's coming up in the next few minutes. We won't say we'll say the name when we introduce the audio, might as well. But stay, buckle up and get ready for some fantastic comic chat in a minute. The year has already started off strong. So thank you for everyone who checked out last week's episode about kids' comics. We go in the opposite direction this week.
Yeah. Hard 180.
In some ways. Yeah. You're going to learn a lot, and certainly.
Oh, you really are. There's a bit of comics history, UK British comics history in that talk, which people should be aware of. Yeah. And should be reading.
Do you know what has already become a bit of UK comics history as well?
Comic House.
I mean, I'm myth. I'm mythic. Do you know what I mean?
Oh, I thought you meant muff.
What are you talking about?
What?
Oh, clear your ears out. Anyway, our sponsors are Comic House.
Yes.
And they're brilliant. And they support this show. Yep. They're an indie comic marketplace that we love, and it's with a difference. On the website, comichouse.com, there's loads of people who are selling their books, their comics through the website. You can list your book on there for free, start selling straight away. But the app that they have, Comic House have an app, and it's brilliant. We love it. The book I'm going to recommend this week is on it, I'll discuss that in a bit anyway. And it's full of fantastic comics. Dan, what's on there at the moment?
We've got some lovely stuff on there.
Yes. Here we go. The one that you're going to name, do that last.
Okay.
The one I'm going to name.
Okay. Yeah.
Well, we got Grey issue 1. That's a brand new release. And then we've got written by Daniel Faulkner and artwork by Reese Finlay. Mahoney's issue 2, Rich Carrington and Richard Dawson. Is that his first name? I can never remember the chat's first name, but his artwork's dynamite. It's a fantastic comic, Mahoney's. And the number one spot, the coveted number one spot in the Comic House chart is the Whore Chronicles.
Hey, look at us.
Tony Esmond and gang.
And Vincenzo, the editor. My editor.
Yeah.
Am I an editor? Well.
You've got an editor credit on Comic House now because I wrote it all out this week.
Oh, wow. Thank you, Tony.
All right, babes.
Small press indie all stars on the Whore Chronicles.
Yeah. Well, basically, there's a lot of people with talent on that book.
Yes.
And I had something to do with it as well.
Good. And Bell Time from our pal Dave Robertson from Viewers goes on as well. Yeah.
Yes.
Get on it. Like upon it.
So, and there's new titles being added there all the time. And it's an enormous library of digitally indie comics. So, basically, if you're a creator, get your work on there. It really is. I mean, if you want to read comics, it's a brilliant thing to use to read comics. And if you want to get your work out to a larger audience, Comic House is brilliant for that. So we highly recommend it in every way, shape, or form. And not just because they sponsor this show.
There's large catalogues of our work is on there.
Yeah, there's quite a few. I was chatting to Pete this week, actually, only yesterday, about some other ideas. He's always full of ideas, Pete, and he's always coming up with stuff. Really interesting.
Yeah. So they're going to take over the world, and remember where you heard about them first. So go to comichouse.com to find out more today. And speaking of today we have a fantastic chat with Mr. Brendan McCarthy
this week.
A name that I know when we shouted it out on the social media, a lot of our listeners were quite excited about. As always, there are listeners who may not know who he is. So, and that's what I love about this show anyway, that, you know, new people would discover new artists, veteran artists, and all kinds of things. But there was, Brendan McCarthy for me was someone that I've only just discovered recently. Even though he's had a hand in one of my favourite things of the past decade.
You loved that. You went on and on about it when it came out, and still do.
I remember. Yeah.
So, yeah, so should we just put the audio in straight away? Why not?
Let's do it.
Yeah, I think so.
Right, this week we are pleased to be joined by an artist, designer and writer whose work has included the likes of Judge Dredd, The Paradox, Mad Max Fury Road and Zorcer of Zilk. I had to make sure I could, I said that right. It's our extreme pleasure to welcome Brendan McCarthy to the show. Hello, sir.
Hi there, guys. How are you?
Hi, Brendan. Good stuff, man. We're very excited. Yeah, all big fans of your work, man. Yeah.
I mean, obviously, people who listen to this show know that we've already been chatting for 10 minutes before this interview even started.
So we'll see that fake hello. Sorry about that. Yeah.
I love it.
Yeah, but it was a good hello. Yeah, thank you for joining us this week. There may be some of our listeners. I know when we put the shout out on the social media and stuff, there was a lot of very excited listeners to find out that you're going to be on the show. Right. And there's certainly probably a lot of people that don't know some of the stuff, for instance, that you've written. You've certainly had a hand in one of my favourite films of the past decade. As well as all the amazing comic artwork. So, but how did you, for those who don't know Brendan McCarthy, I mean, we're not going, this is your life. Yeah. But, you know, how did you get started in comics and how did it all start?
Well, if we go back in the time machine about the comics industry, it was completely different to what it is now. I mean, basically, the battle was won, which was to get comics in as an art form, to develop it and get it away from the hack end of the newspaper industry, which is what it was.
Okay.
And, so we were the first. We were basically the generation I came up with. Alan Moore, Brian Tolbert, and myself and Brett Ewins were probably the first three individuals that are still around that actually struck out and produced independent comics and strips. This was in the mid-70s when the punk stuff was happening.
Yeah.
So what you had in England at the time was a fading underground, 60s underground kind of distribution of, Robert Crumb comics and the Fabulous Furry Freak Brothers and that stuff. That was all there was other than, what were they called? I can't remember. They're called IPC or something like that. Then okay. Valiant and Battle and all that stuff. Mm. So that's what you had. And I was at art college, knew Brett Ewins. He was a local guy. We were both two local working class kids in West London.
Nice.
Both got into art college. And Brett knew a guy at college who was an interesting writer called Pete Milligan. I didn't know Pete, but Brett did. And that's sort of how the kind of comics collective idea we had started to grow. We were thinking, is it possible to come like the Beatles in comics? That was the sort of idea.
That was a hell of a year at your college. I've got to tell you, Brett, you and Pete Milligan all at once. Yeah.
Yeah, and Tony Wright. Because we'd grown up reading comics and then the American comics had come over to England and were available on spinner racks. So I'm at the age where I was actually buying, Jack Kirby Fantastic Fours off the spinner racks the month they come out, that sort of stuff.
Amazing, yeah.
I was raised on the 60s Silver Age stuff, and was... As a kid, I started to notice the same artist name, notice the different styles, and I knew who Stan Lee was because he was such a sort of rah-rah sort of cheerleader for all. So in those days, comics were considered, it would be like proffering a turd on a stick to somebody if you showed it.
We've all done that.
Exactly. And so... There was that sense of we would definitely have conversations and produce our own. At the time when the punk thing came out, fanzines were the order of the day, and so we produced our own fanzines. Brett Ewins produced a fanzine called Tricky House, and I drew strips for that, and Brett did some for it. Pete Milligan did bits of writing for it. And that was the sort of how everybody, pretty much how everybody starts off, isn't it? You produce your own comics. And I noticed that there was a magazine called, music magazine called Sounds. In those days, everybody religiously read the music papers, New Musical Express, Sounds, Melody Maker, including Alan, including Brian Tolbert.
Yeah, I think it was Alan Moore in an earlier issue of Sounds as well.
What happened was somebody was doing a strip in Sounds, it stopped, and I thought, hang on a minute, maybe there's a vacancy there. So I actually put together a strip called The Electric Hoax, wrote a couple of episodes, photocopied it, and sent them into him saying, why don't you do a punk kind of strip? Because the stuff before had been sort of Fabulous Furry Freak Brothers dope smoking stuff.
Yeah.
Okay. They said, great, can you, and they paid me something like 25 quid, which was, which was just more than the dole. So I thought, I'm going to try and earn a living drawing comics and writing them. So I wrote and drew something called The Electric Hoax, which is a sort of punk rock inspired, sort of William Burroughs-y type of comic. And I was starting to, just spend so much time on the writing that I asked Pete Milligan to give me a hand with it. And then gradually, we just became a team naturally through that. And I said, well, you might as well co-own it with me and let's just do it all together.
Okay, and music's always been, it's something that I've always seen in, strangely, always seen in your work. I mean,
yeah, of course,
I know it's oversaid, but you're almost like glam rock meets Ditko is where I sort of see your
lot of
your
work. Exactly. And also, the techniques by which I tell the story, a lot of people are frustrated with my stuff because they think, well, it's kind of not like a smooth TV episode, which is how most people are writing TV episodic stuff.
Yeah.
And, or filmic cuts and all that, obviously since Alan Moore and Frank Miller. I was sort of, I like the, so if you just see my stuff as like cut and styled like a pop video, it just makes perfect sense of it. It's not really that complicated.
Yeah, and there's a certain like some of the stuff like the Rogan Josh sort of, there's a certain album cut, those classic sort of 70s psychedelic album cover sort of aesthetics
going on
there.
Definitely see that.
Yeah.
There's a surrealist element,
Well, one of the things that's happened in culture is that the pivotal part that music played in culture has diminished massively now to the point where it's almost, music's become invisible. In the culture, whereas before in the 60s, 70s, 80s, 90s, it's starting to, they're still and then starting to go. I was, massively influenced by music, far more than films. So if you put music and comics together, that's where I'm coming from. Okay. I mean, I understand film narrative because I've spent 20 years working in films. But when I go back to comics, the last thing I want to do is basically do a glorified storyboard. So I want to, I'm trained as a fine artist. So my thing is that I'm interested that in that world of fine art, an artist isn't subservient to a writer. An artist is a voice in his own right. Like Picasso is no less than James Joyce, for example.
Yeah.
Whereas in comics, you've got, since the advent of the graphic novel and the publishing model and libraries, the idea is now, they just look at it like kids' books. They think, oh, the author is the main voice and the illustrator is interchangeable. It doesn't matter who draws it. And there's
it's moved to that a bit now, isn't it, recently, I think?
Yeah, but a lot of editors and publishers who actually agree with that. Axel Alonso has famously said, it doesn't matter, the artist isn't important.
Right.
Just to get back to, the kind of overall thing of where I'm coming from, the music press was important because music was so important. And, I ended The Electric Hoax. I thought that's the story's gone on long enough. And then when that ended, Alan Moore saw the opening and he went in.
Okay.
So I became aware of Alan Moore. He was aware of me, and we were aware of Brian Talbot because he was the first to put out his own independent comic called Brainstorm Comics, which is basically a dope smoking very Freak Brothers thing.
Yeah.
Shortly after he put out Brainstorm, myself and Brett Ewins put out our own comic called Sometime Stories, which was not a dope smoking hippie comic. It was more like a proto indie Vertigo comic before any of that stuff existed. And you look at the Sometime Stories, it's obviously crudely drawn and very badly written as early things are. But what you can see in it, though, is the blueprint of the style, the kind of urban surrealism, the punky attitude, the sort of slightly fuck you about sort of thing about it. And getting something published meant that we could send it. Well, there weren't very many venues, but we sent it into Kelvin Gosnell at 2000 AD, which had just come out.
Okay. I was wondering how that connection started. Yeah.
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 Then 2000 AD came out, and I in a newsagent, in the corner of a newsagent, I saw, you know, now and then you'd look at the comics. I'd stopped reading them long ago, the British stuff. I saw, what's this? And I picked up 2000 AD the first week and thought, no. And I didn't buy it. Second week, I looked at it again, and on the back was Dread. I thought, this is good. So I bought it and then went around Brett's house, all my way around Brett's house at the time. Have you seen this, Brett? And he goes, no, what's that? He goes, look at this Judge Dredd thing. What do you think? And it was, it might have been Mick McMahon on the first one. I think that was published.
Right. Yeah, I think you're right.
Yeah. And then you saw artists like Ian Gibson. And I thought, well, hang on, this guy's got a kind of an American vibe to him. He's not really that Eric Bradbury type of stuff.
Yeah, there's a Joe Staten feel a little bit about him, isn't there?
Exactly.
Yeah.
Exactly. And so should we try and get a, you know, let's do something for him. And so I phoned up Kelvin. I managed to somehow get through him. I don't know how. And I said, listen, how do we pitch you, or what are you looking for? He said, get me some cover ideas and send them in. So we sent in about 6 sketches for cover ideas, you know, like silly ones, and he picked 2, and suddenly we had a gig.
Nice.
Cool. So we had to work out how to draw, because we'd never drawn, you know, professionally before. Yeah. So we knew that they did. So Steve Ditko did a thing in the Spider-Man annual where he showed how he draws Spider-Man, which he drew as a comic strip. Right. And we knew that you did it twice up. And he was looking at, we didn't know how to use the brushes with Indian ink. So we bought rapidographs, these tiny little rapidographs, and thick lines, you know, governing lines around the outside of the shape or something. We would draw them and then fill them in with rapidographs. And we were both taught work on the picture together. I was Brett was good at feet, and I was good at hands, you know, sort of stuff like that. Anyway, so we actually got something in print about, a few months later, suddenly there in a newsagent was our cover to 2000 AD. And it was like,
was your first cover? I can't remember.
Something ridiculously silly, like, you know, I think it might be an alien coming out of a comic book page with an artist going, oh my God, the drawing, it's come alive.
Ah, okay.
Something like that. It was
So anyway. So what was your first sequential? Was it Future Shocks or was it Dread?
By this stage, people like Brian Bolland, Dave Gibbons, were pretty much sort of doing stuff regularly.
Yeah.
And I thought, and they were saying, you know, so we got was phone calls saying, listen, we're stuck for a Strontium Dog strip or a Judge Dredd strip in a summer special. Can you do it? He would say, yeah, thing is, you only got 2 weeks. I said, okay. And we just took it on and we'd do it, and it was crap. But it was in print, we were being paid, and we would just keep going. And that's the thing, above everything else, if you say, you know, you're going to do it and you are going to do it, you're going to get better. We just were shit in public and then got good. Whereas, you know, sometimes you get artists like Jaime Hernandez, who are perfectly formed.
Fully formed immediately, yeah, I know what you mean, yeah.
And their work
yeah.
never changes. I mean, I stopped reading comics for about 15 years at a certain point in the 90s up through the early 1000s. Hadn't looked at his work for 20 years, picked it up, and it's almost like I could have just picked it up from...
I agree.
That kind of ability to be that fully formed very quickly. Like Brian Bolland had also a very short incubation time before he became, you know, super great. If you look at his early Dreads, they're actually a little bit wonky, but he quickly became, you know, the classic Bolland, and then those amazing run of Dreads he did, like Forever... Is it the Forever Sleep or the Forever War?
Forever War, is it? I think, off the top of my head. Yeah.
Just things like, you know, by Cyrogenic Freezing. I remember all that. And the one where the Jack the Ripper with the fog frozen. I mean, everybody was going, wow, look at this, you know. One thing I want to stress as well was how great it was. I could walk into a newsagent, pick up 2000 AD.
Yeah, I agree.
I went back to 2000 because I said, I just want to get my stuff out to me, age 14, in a newsagent in Coventry somewhere. Some kid's going to walk in, pick up 2000 AD and see the Sorcerer's Silk and think, what the fuck is this? You know, I want to do what it did to me, you know?
Yeah, no, I agree completely, man, yeah.
So somewhere out there, there's a version of me who is going to have his life changed and get into comics. You know, that's what I bear in mind when I do it. So that is the great thing still about 2000 AD, that it's the closest we've got to sort of like, you know, a national institution in British comics. Because just think about it, there is nothing left in comics other than 2000 AD in terms of nationally syndicated, available in ordinary shops, Tesco's.
W.H. Smith's, yeah.
It's the only thing left. And if you want to stay out of that whole, you know, comic scene, comic shop thing, which is, you got to think, you remember, it's really isolated, that scene. Mm. You know, how many people in the country go to comic shops? Very few.
Yeah.
So one of the things I want to do is sort of bypass it. And even though 2000 AD will always be in those shops, the thing that I like about 2000 AD, just ordinary non-comic nerdy, non-nerdy type people, just regular plumber who thinks, oh, 2000 AD, I'll have a bit of that.
Yeah. Yeah. Do you know what still flies the flag for that at the moment is Viz, I think. I stopped in a couple of motorway services, and that's still available in, you know, you can get that in every motorway. It's on the top shelf, mind you, but yeah. Still a bit
that's
of that.
Interesting, yeah.
I mean, Viz isn't my kind of market, so.
Yeah, no, I get you. Yeah.
I mean, basically, yeah, you're right, Viz. And there's things like DC Thompson stuff, but again, not my thing. I think 2000 AD remains still probably the only venue to do a reasonably intelligent, artistically sort of creative piece of work, create a character that might interact and connect. Hence, I thought, well, I had a sort of vague idea for a new Zorsa result, and I thought I'd love to. I just want to do it for 2000 AD. Since I came back into comics, you know, I got, you know, I've done hit DC Comics, I've done Marvel. I thought, well, I should really do 2000 AD and sort of come home, as it were. You know?
Yeah, because you started on, you know, Tharg's Future Shocks and Dread, and you did Freakwave and stuff like that, and then you disappeared off to. Didn't disappear off, but you concentrate a little bit on movies from time to time. Is that right in saying that?
I was fully present and doing groundbreaking, wonderful stuff through the whole 80s British invasion type stuff, you know, Wham Pow, comics aren't for kids anymore, all that crap.
You work for Eclipse. I really do like the stuff you did, Strange Days and stuff.
Yeah, Strange Days was a completely rad comic in its day, but it got, the thing is, Alan Moore, Frank Miller, Neil Gaiman, they just sort of sucked all the oxygen out of the room and nothing ever got looked at. So it was all just... But Strange Days, as, you know, people like Warren Ellis have said, everybody read Strange Days, went out and formed their own comic band.
Sort
of hired a space similar to the Velvet Underground and Lou Reed and all that stuff, just while all the hip stuff was at its zenith in the 60s, there were these bunch of freaks doing this other stuff that was totally different. And with the advent of glam rock and Bowie, who had brought trash into the culture after it become, you know, sort of concept rock and all that stuff.
Yeah.
Trash returned to the culture through the influence of the Velvet Underground and Bowie, and then Lou Reed resurfaced, and that led to the Sex Pistols and punk rock. So our hearts were more with that, and we had to just wait until punk rock happened to suddenly be on the wave that's natural for you. Now, I'm too old to ride whatever wave is coming up next, but there'll always be something.
Yeah, I'm too old for the YouTube generation, I've got to be honest with you. Snapchat's lost me. Yeah, I can imagine there's something riding the wave there, but I'm never going to see it, Brendan.
Yeah, I'm talking more about possibly youth cults, you know, comic stuff, you know.
Okay, yeah.
Okay. I mean, the attention span seems to be shorter with like the modern generation as well, isn't it? Like, I mean, things like, you know, the social media, like Snapchat or Vine, everything's like 6 seconds and it's done, isn't it? Whereas we used to pick up a weekly comic, or, well, I mean, still do, a lot of us out there, and I know a lot of our listeners. Yeah. You know, we'll pick up a comic and then you'll spend days looking at it. You know, once you finish the story, sometimes you could just be staring at the artwork for about a week. You know, that was the experience.
Well, I'm very much... I read once and look many times. I don't read comics over and over again, but I look at them over and over again.
Yeah.
Mm. That's interesting. I know I'd quite like to touch on it, and we will get to Zorsa in a second, but something we've all reread this week was Skin. Having mentioned punk and from that skinhead culture, I just wanted to touch a little bit on it, if you don't mind, Brendan. So that started as, was it a project for Crisis? Am I right in saying that?
Yeah, that's right. Yeah, in the sort of I think Crisis is early 90s, isn't it? I can't remember.
Yes, you're right. Yeah,
late
80s, I think. Yeah, yeah.
It was part of the whole, you know, comics boom of the 80s. You know, our post Watchmen and Dark Knight and everything, and people. Pat Mills, I think, was a prime mover on that. And
He was. Yep. Yeah. In fact, I spoke to Pat earlier about you, and he was extolling on how brilliant, game changer your covers were. Yeah, he was saying that, you know, you you possibly change the game for covers, which I know you've just mentioned, but yeah, mean, I know he's a big promoter of yours.
Right. I've met him a few times, very nice person. And he's kind of, he's not really, I don't feel that he's very acknowledged within the industry as being actually, so him and Wagner are just as important to me.
Yes,
as
I agree completely. Yeah.
Game,
yeah.
But they've never really broke America. That's why it's all about American stuff. That was what used to really frustrate me about the British comic scenes, that no matter what you did in Britain, it was kind of, as soon as you did it in America, they were all out there, were kind of like hanging onto your leg as you walk through a convention. That sort of
literally
thing.
You have to break
in America before the British fans really get you.
So how did Skin come about? Because it is, I actually believe it's a forgotten classic. I'll be honest with you, Brendan.
I think it's our made in Britain, if you know that Tim Roth.
Very much so.
Yeah, very much so. I can see that.
Yeah. So did it come as I know it was yourself and Pete Milligan. How did it start? Can you remember?
Well, it came from me. Because I was now writing with Pete Milligan and we'd done Freakwave together for Eclipse and we did Strange Days. Chronologically, Skin came after those.
Oh, okay, right.
And all that stuff. So I'd had the idea for Skin, for about 10 years. I just used to see a Thalidomide guy who was wearing Ben Sherman shirts because they had short sleeves. Walk around.
Which was a Skinner classic, wasn't it? It was a sort of Skinner culture go-to shirt, wasn't it? Yeah.
And so it was an image, it was just a guy that I used to see around. I used to see Thalidomide people around quite a bit because I'm of the same generation that had my mother taken the drug. I could well have been sporting that deformity myself. Anyway, I spoke to Pete about it and said, listen, Pete, I don't know if you'd be interested in this, but I've got this idea for a story about a Thalidomide skinhead, and why don't we do something that looks at corporate violence versus skinhead violence, the social violence of skinheads, which is tut-tutted and isn't it terrible
Daily Mail fodder.
And then you've got the corporate violence of Thalidomide and just all that sort of stuff, and how those people can lawyer, and I mean the story of the Thalidomide thing is really disgusting, and how they just lawyered them into submission, lawfare. So I had the story. Look, there's this guy called Martin Atcher. He's a Thalidomide skinhead, and in the end he tracks down the guy, the CEO of the corporation that put the stuff out. We had to change all the names. Hilarious. We were legally advised to change the names from whatever they were. I can't remember the name of the company that put it out now. Thalidomide. Is it Farben? And we had to make one up because I said, well, you can't say that because it'd be libelous. And we said, but they actually did put out Thalidomide.
Yeah.
But start to understand the world of lawyerism and all that stuff. Anyway, so I just sat with Pete, told him the story as I had it in my head, and Pete went away. And I said, listen, just write it. At the time, everybody was trying to push it. And IPC was saying, Crisis, we really want to do something new. It's going to be really edgy and far out. I said, okay, you want edgy? We'll give you fucking edgy.
I know one of the reasons it didn't initially see print is because did the printers refuse to print it? Yeah.
Yes.
Yeah. Okay. Right.
Wow. Well, what happened is the printers union halted the presses. No, sorry, that's not right. They didn't hold the press. They saw the some previews of it and said, what the fuck is this? And this is the same people printing, Reader's Wise and all that.
Exactly.
They had a fit of the morals. And so they said, we're not printing this. The language is offensive. It's offensive. It's sort of like exploiting disabled people, blah, 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 all that stuff.
Yeah.
And then the lawyers...
It's the opposite of what it's doing. Yeah.
Of course it is. And you got to understand, this is all, the thing about everything now is that when you're breaking the boundaries 30 years ago to allow what's happening now to happen, now you look back on stuff, you think, well, what's the big deal? But it's the same. Mm. Just think, the Beatles were once revolutionary with their long hair. Now you think they're about as revolutionary as one of those, I don't know.
There's people who are now accepted by the establishment.
Yesterday's rad is tomorrow's dad, as they say.
I've never heard that one. Yeah,
no, that's good. So, I mean, the it is extremely brutal, isn't it? And we won't ruin, because I think people should go out and find it, because it's in the Milligan and McCarthy collection, isn't it?
It's the best of Milligan and McCarthy. It's a really good collection and a very good price as well, and it's in there, you know, in it, all its glory.
Yeah, and there's some extra pin-ups and stuff like that. And the
colour... I found some of the extra bits and pieces that hadn't been published and stuck them all in there.
Real, yeah. And who did the colour on that? I forget.
I did the colour with Carol Swain. I mean, it's my project. I mean, you know, if I invent the... See, when we talked about writing a little bit earlier, I mean, that might have been before the show. You see, if somebody invents a character, invents the story, that's called writing.
Yeah. Yeah.
You know, it's not like so at the time I realized retrospectively me and Pete had a very interactive relationship. Because it was ego free, that was why.
Yeah, we collaborative.
Just, yeah.
And we were having a laugh and also we were egging each other on. So when Pete wrote a little bit of some sample of Skin, which I thought didn't go far enough, and I said, Pete, you know how these people talk, you know how they think.
Yeah.
For fuck's sake, go fucking write a fucking comic.
the dialogue is one of the best bits of it as well. I mean, it's brilliant. But
sorry,
the dialogue in it, Brendan, is incredible. It is so real. You know.
Yeah. God. Yeah.
You almost have to read it out loud at moments. Yeah.
Yeah. And the thing is that when I got that script off Pete, it was the best script. I feel it's the best single comic script I've ever had. You know, right. It was so bloody good, and it was shockingly good. And I thought, fuck it, his script is basically now going to blow any art or anything I ever do out the door. But, then I had to go, right, okay, let's get this sorted out. And I wanted something that wasn't just looking like a 2000 AD thing or sort of had the 60s American influence in, as my stuff does. So, you know, this was not a Ditko sort of homage or anything. So I loved Carol Swain's art. She was doing Way Out Strips, which was an indie black and white strip drawn with crayons. So it had a rough grain in it. So I got in touch with Carol and said, listen, she knew my stuff. And I said to her, would you be interested in working with me on colouring a new thing? And I'll pay you. You know, and she, you know, said, great. And so for her, it was a different experience. For me, you know, and she got paid. And so she, you know, she made very little money off her strip, so it was, at least it was a bit of money for her. And I would basically pencil and then ink a very clear line, black line ink, very thin on colored paper. Okay. I'd give them to her. She would then color them up, she'd come around, or we'd meet up for coffee, and she'd then give me, say, 10 pages worth of stuff. I'd take them home. Then I'd look at what she'd done, and some of them would be just gorgeous as they were. They'd need a little bit here and there, or she'd lost an expression, or it wasn't quite right in something. No, so I'd do bits on them, and other pages, she, you know, they just didn't quite work. They didn't gel properly. So I would then actually have to work a lot on them, you know, over the top of what she'd done. So you can see as the strip goes through, it's very, it's sort of like drawn by the drunken artist or something, because it goes on quite a loose kind of almost crayony, badly drawn. I mean, it was self-consciously badly drawn as well. What I didn't want to do was make it all super slick airbrush and all that stuff, because I felt if this is just a 14-year-old working class kid and the voice of the author's voice is like, fucking hell, mate, you know, it's that, then the art itself has got to match that in that it can't be too sophisticated. It's got to be cool.
Yeah, there's got to be a brutality about it, isn't there?
And how it's drawn is very rough as well. So you'll see, if you look at Skin, you'll think, oh, that's very Carol Swain, those pages, and that one's a bit more Brendan. You can just see how it wafts in and out.
Okay.
I mean, how did the colour choices come about? Because, you know, it's such a beautifully colourful sort of story. I mean, even though it goes to dark subjects matter. I mean, you know, there is colour all over these pages. And
God, yeah, yeah.
You know, from sort of standard, you know, like summer field greens to sort of like, you know, real psychedelic sort of magentas and purples and things like that. You know, did you have those colours in mind, or was that a collab?
Well, I knew it was going to, you know, I'm quite influenced by, I did a BA in fine art, and so I'm a painter initially. And right. So I'm very influenced by the Fauvists and Expressionists and, you know, different other forms. But that in particular in skin, how I use colour is I'm if you ever study people like Matisse, they were able to use colour to describe space and form and rather than line work, you see. And I've always sort of learnt that lesson that colour can do a lot of work. So,
yeah,
you know, just
that's interesting. Wasn't Patrick Caulfield your tutor? Is that right?
Yeah. Yeah, well, yeah. Patrick, one of the great colorist pop artists of the 60s. Yeah. You know, next to Hockney and Kitaj, they were the big ones, and Peter Blake and who's that? Alan Jones.
He would be the other. He's a really bold choice of colors, isn't he? He's really strong color.
And his stuff is bounded by black line, although it's it's an abstracted black line, you know. But
really interesting. Yeah. Oh, nice. So should we move on a little bit from Skinner? Oh, the only other thing I wanted to say was that you ended up being published by, was it Tundra ended up taking it on?
What was great was the lawyers at Crisis said, we're not publishing this, this is whatever. So basically Steve McManus reluctantly, he said, look, sorry guys, you know, I tried, but I've been overruled. We said, okay, don't worry. I mean, although it's a good anecdote for the late night chat shows, we got our comic banned by whatever. The problem is you don't get paid. So, I'll be honest, you know, the thing about me is drawing comics is not that lucrative and I'm very slow. So therefore, what was quite shocking for people who think that it was all a big glamorous time. I mean, I lived under the poverty line for that whole decade of the 80s, you know, just scrambling for, you know, living off baked beans and porridge, basically. So, all that time in the 80s, there wasn't lots of money in it. I mean, there was a bit like Alan Moore and the amount that The Watchmen sold, Neil Gaiman, etc. But we were sort of a left field, a different kind of faction to those guys.
Okay.
And okay. I mean, you can plot a strand through our stuff, you know, myself and Brett Ewins. Brett Ewins then goes on to do Deadline. Deadline leads to Jamie Hewlett. Jamie Hewlett is influenced by my stuff massively.
Oh, you can tell, yeah, straight away.
Yeah, yeah. I'm just saying, he used to do comics about me, if you believe it or not. And so then you've got the Jamie Hewlett Gorillaz and all that sort of music kind of angle that runs through the strand that comes from myself and Brett with Sometimes Stories and all that Rogan Gosh and Strange Days and all that stuff. So there's a bunch of people, Shaky Kane. There's a whole different strata of artists that run parallel to the sort of Gaiman, Alan Moore axis. I mean, Grant Morrison was sort of hung out with us as well. He was quite into that at the time, you know, but, you know, he's kind of gone more whatever he's doing now.
I know you worked with him on designs quite a lot, didn't you? Is that right?
He asked me, I created a character called Paradax. And then Pete Milligan wrote it. Again, it was another character I created, developed all the side characters, wrote the story, and then went to Pete Milligan and said, could you actually just write the script?
Cool.
In those days, you know, because we just worked together, I wasn't that bothered about the credits. But retrospectively, I should have taken a writer's co-credit because everybody thinks Pete invented it all and I was the artist. Because that's the problem now with credits and writers in comics is that basically everybody assumes the writer does everything and the artist illustrates it. You know,
one of my favourite things about Paradax is he gets his arse handed to him in the first four pages or something. Doesn't he get a kick in a bar virtually straight away?
It's because his manager sold his secret identity to a tabloid.
That's right,
But you've got to understand, that came out just as Watchmen was coming out. It was a completely new take on superheroes. Different to The Watchmen because it was a bit more rock and roll and a bit more, you know, fuck you. Watchmen was a more serious attempt at deconstruction and you can say all those words about it. Paradax was doing all that too, but we just didn't want to, we wanted to do something like a great pop single, you know.
Okay.
So that was our attitude, that our thing, that those little 30-page stories were more like pop singles than they were graphic novels, you know. We weren't at all portentous or pretentious about our stuff. So if we, and also for me, if I could say it in 8 pages, I'd rather say it in 8 pages than 300. You know, I'm not.
Yeah. Okay. Yeah. Like a punk song, almost, isn't it?
Well, exactly. Yeah. And philosophically, I'm taken with sort of things like Zen Buddhism, which are about instantaneous understanding rather than linear understanding through literature. So.
Okay. Cool. Yeah. So you meant you're about to mention about you designed some stuff for Grant Morrison there. Was it Zenith you designed some stuff for?
So after Paradox comes out, kind of a year or so later, Steve McManus at 2000 ETHAG says, we're going to be doing a superhero strip, and Grant Morrison, who's writing it, would like you to design it. I said, okay, cool. So I had an idea of what he was going to do. So I did some designs. He was a bit, again, it was sort of, you know, the jacket type superhero. I was the first guy who did that. Whereas, say, all those jacketed superheroes that came afterwards all came from the idea of you wearing your regular clothes over your costume came from Paradox.
Yeah. So that's what we're talking about is that Zenith famously had this sort of cool leather jacket he would wear on the top.
Yeah, all that stuff was designed by me. And Zenith, the reason I didn't draw Zenith was that when I actually read the script, I thought, oh, this is just ripped off Paradox. He's got a manager, he's a media star.
Interesting. Yeah.
So I'm inclined to draw it after that, but not before I designed it.
Yeah.
Also, I do think usually when I can't do something, it works out for the best. For example, Steve Yeol, I thought, was the perfect artist for Zenith. He would have been better than me on Zenith. So perfect, worked out perfectly. Not many people know I was also offered Arkham Asylum. I turned it down because I think I was a film was coming up, and I wanted to, I just wanted to get a break from comics. And Dave McKean did it, and he was the much better choice than me. You know, so. It's one of Dave's, I think, still one of his greatest pieces.
Oh yeah, definitely. I mean, you've talked there about like moving from comics like into the land of movies and stuff, which is something that we, you know, that I see a lot of. There's some creators that, you know, you love their artwork, and you think, where have they gone? Have they just stopped working?
Exactly.
But they're actually working behind the scenes for movie. You know, you open up a movie concept art book, and all of a sudden you're seeing this artwork from one of your
favorite. Yeah, like Lynn did that. His beautiful graphic novel, great statement. And then I can assure you, I know that if he did that graphic novel and to that quality with that amount of pages, he earned bugger all. So he probably needed to do a movie to earn some money again.
Yeah, certainly.
The primary reason I got out of comics was the 80s thing sort of spilled into the 90s a bit, and then Image Comics started, and then it was glossy covers selling a million. And my era was now over officially. It's a bit like you're a rock and roller and suddenly disco comes in.
Okay. Yeah.
So
you
realize, oh, my time is over. I'm in that decade, really. That was, you know, the Beatles are in the 60s, you know, Bowie's of the 70s or glam rock is, and, you know, my comic, you know, when you're actually trailblazing and breaking new ground and you're on your roll, a big roll, my period is the 80s. So in the 90s I gradually moved out of comics into initially pop videos, then into Hollywood feature films for another 10 years, and then came back to comics.
Everyone comes back in the end. But I mean, there are some people out there who may not know that you've done some work in movies. I mean, what are some titles that you've worked on that you can say that you've worked on that people may have seen or may not be aware that you had a hand in?
Well, there's probably about half a dozen ones you would know. Starting with Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles, the first one, where I worked with the director I'd done some pop videos with. The director who did Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles, Steve Barron, was the guy who did Take On Me, you know, the R. Harvey.
That's Dan's favourite song, actually.
Well, you know, where he interacts with the comic book thing. Steve Barron was quite savvy about comics. He needed a comic book guy to do some stuff for him, not that video, but something else. And they got in touch with me. I went along and saw him, turned in some great stuff for him. He said, listen, can you do this as well? And then one day I got a call from him where he says, have you ever heard of anything called Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles? And I said, yeah, of course. It's massive. It's back in those days, it wasn't a movie, but it was the phenomenon in comics.
Well, Kevin Eastman wasn't Kevin Eastman responsible for publishing Skin?
Was. That's how it all connects.
Right. Okay.
So what happened is, I'll just briefly finish up with Skin. What was hilarious is that when Skin got banned and withdrawn, Crisis, Time Out, a London listings magazine, had a guy who did their listings, who was also a comic fan, heard about it and did a 2-page feature on, you know, Skin, the banned comic. Then Penguin Books got in touch with us, and then So-and-So Books, and then all these publishers got hold of us. And every time we'd send out to them, they'd suddenly withdraw. Oh, right. No thanks. The thing about, as Pete Milligan pointed out, is that if this had been done as a sort of sensitive boy poet who has thalidomide in Hampstead, you know, who ultimately commits suicide due to his deformity, you know, then that would have been, you know, if I gave it the kind of poetic Neil Gaiman approach, they would have gone for it. But because it was actually a working class, gammon comic, it was like, it was too, it was not that it was too outré, but it was culturally too vulgar for them.
It was shouting too loud, wasn't it? Almost.
Yeah, and also it didn't care about them. You know, it didn't care that Guardian readers might approve of it or not. In fact, it really wanted them not to approve of it. And, we had all the big publishers come after it and all of them turned it down. And, you know, they were all going about, cutting edge comics, you know, but not too cutting edge, please. And in the end, we did have, what was it? We had to submit it to Customs, because Kevin Eastman had said he'd do it and he'd have to print them overseas and import them in. And Customs said, if you bring this in, we'll prosecute you.
Wow,
Jesus Christ.
Yeah, so then Kevin Eastman said, in that case, I'll fund a court case.
Wow, okay.
And he had very deep pockets then. And in the end, after a bit of correspondence, the customs people said, oh, who gives a fuck it? You know, they didn't say fuck it, but you know what I mean.
Yeah.
That's just to wrap up the scheme. With cash, published it. It came out actually to reasonable acclaim, and we were really helped by a guy who was a punk rock drummer who also had thalidomide. And he was very vocal in his support for it, because we had a few of those sort of middle class Radio 4 shows like Does He Take Sugar, a program for disabled people. And this guy, he actually went on the show and they said, you know, isn't this offensive to disabled people? And he said, no, not at all. You know, and he just sort of said, no, not at all.
It's not, though, is it? It's almost a hero for people who suffered from that, you know.
And also, what it did. Yeah. It didn't show, you know how most of your sort of disabled sort of promotional charity stuff is often black and white photo of somebody in a wheelchair, can't reach the ATM or something, and, you know, think it would be like this was you. You know, sort of a victim sort of angle. Whereas this guy thought, right, fuck being a victim, I'm going to go and fuck these people over more than they fucked everybody else over. It was structured on Taxi Driver, really, is what I did.
Very much. I can see that now. Yeah, you mentioned it.
It was comics, Taxi Driver. You know, it was.
Oh, we won't spoil it, but that last panel, man, the event at the end is incredibly strong.
I happen to think one of the most iconic panels I've ever done, and in British comics, is the shot of him standing up saying, fucking all right, with his grin on his face when he's done the most insane thing ever. You know, and everybody else is puking and he's going, all right, yeah.
I first read this when I was in secondary school. Someone else in the class had it and I borrowed it. Yeah. And that one where he kind of comes running along into the fight and there's someone's like, Jesus shit, it's fucking Frankenstein. Yeah. That was like, whoa, that was really heavy. Because obviously, you don't see like people being portrayed like that and that kind of attitude. So,
real shock. The thing about all those sort of, you know, white middle class, sort of nice Radio 4, Does He Take Sugar? That's the name of their disabled.
Yeah, I remember that show.
They hated it, of course. And they got the, I wish I could remember his name now. He's really terrific. He's a fantastic guy. He went on the show and he just absolutely slaughtered them and defended it and, you know, and said, you know, just because a disabled person isn't a victim, just because he's not. Shall I tell you the story about how Channel 4 attempted to turn it into a TV series?
Yeah, I'd love to hear that. Yeah.
Yeah.
So Channel 4 come along to us and say, hey, look, you know, we've heard about this skin thing. Really, you know, it's back then all the hipsters wore ponytails. And so we had these two pairs of ponytail twats from Channel 4 came up. And they're saying, look, we really want to do this. We want to make it. You know, we're going to do it live action to be really heavy hitting. You know, all this type of stuff, right? We thought, great. And they say, there's just one thing. Can you limit the amount of difference in the, because we've got a sort of, you know,
this is a Nathan Barley moment, isn't it? It really is. Yeah.
Exactly that. And then they come back. Listen, you know the Fox? Can we take down the Fox and lose the completely? Negotiate the swearing. Then they come back with, look, what we're thinking of doing is this is really hot young actor. I said, oh, he's thalidomide, is he? He goes, well, no. What we're going to do is tie his hands behind him, but his back, and put on fake hands on his shoulders. And I said, but that's going to look really horrible. You know, it's going to look really bad. You know, fake hands on his shoulders. And so they come back to us and say, look, does he have to be a thalidomide? Why can't he just be disabled?
Oh, Jesus Christ.
So in the end, they'd look, see you later.
I remember hearing a story, sorry Matt,
they eventually ripped the idea off and did a show about this nasty little guy in who didn't have any legs and swore at everybody, and he was an actual actor who was disabled in that way,
right?
And
it
just
ripped
the idea off and, you know, did it that way. So
I remember hearing a Hollywood story about a movie, I think Richard Gere was in it or something, about a manic depressive, and then the memo came back, can he be a bit more manic and can we lose the depression? Yeah.
Yeah, it's pretty sort of standard stuff.
Yeah.
But it was fun. It was a bit fun, but,
Yeah, great stuff, man. Lovely to hear that, yeah. Should we move it on to Fury Road? So...
Yeah,
I know people will be really looking forward to hear you talk a bit about that. But as I understand it, Freequave was kind of inspired by Mad Max. Was that right?
That's right. Yeah. I was. I saw Mad Max 2 when I was about 20. Most of your listeners are too young to know the effect that Mad Max 2 had on the culture when it came out. But it came out just when punk had kind of peaked. You know, it was all, so people understood the iconography and everything like that. And it was the writer J.G. Ballard called Road Warrior a punk Sistine Chapel.
Wow, I didn't know that. Okay.
Yeah. And I was completely obsessed with it. I thought it actually blown me away when I saw it in the cinema. I just couldn't, it was like, I was totally, immersed in the film. I was on the edge of my seat. That final tanker chase is probably the greatest action sequence ever in cinema. I still actually don't think we beat it in Fury Road, to be frank, because there's a raw gutsiness to it. And also, I think Mel Gibson was a better Mad Max than Tom Hardy, you know. But
yeah, I agree.
Shouldn't really say that, should I?
He had more lines, that's for sure.
Well, it's not so much that, it's about presence, isn't it? And that's the only thing about Fury Road that really... If Mel Gibson had done that... You know, when we originally were going to do it, because it took 10 years to get it made, it was still viable before he went nutso. I think him and Charlize Theron would have been a good match. You know, I think Mel would have been. She dominated Tom too much, I felt. And also, George Miller, when I was writing, I spent 2 years writing Fury Road with him, and all the time I was saying, listen, George, his Fury Road was his character, his new character, and he really was in love with her, wanted to do it. Blah, 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 blah. And he was kind of a bit bored with Mad Max because he's done him 3 times. And I was in the end the advocate for Mad Max. I kept pushing Max into the screen all the time and saying, nagging George about how, look, Max, I remember saying, direct quote, look, Max has become a passenger in his own movie. We've got to get him back in here as more of a viable thing. Now, I wrote a scene with George, which then got changed because of the political concerns of the feminism which they were going more and more on when I left. I was restraining George on that stuff because I said it's too didactic. It's the girl kicking the chastity belt says more about what you're trying to say than all the slogans painted on the walls and all that stuff.
Okay.
I thought that was overkill. So I had argued don't do that stuff, and then he put it all back in again, and I felt it was a little bit, you know, rah-rah feminist stuff, and I just wanted that's too strong in the film. And to this day I still think that was a little bit too polemical. George is an amazing talent, but I felt his weakness was as an artist was a desire to be didactic. And I said, people hate that, nobody likes being lectured in films, don't do it. And we didn't have fights, but we had strong discussions, put it that way.
Cool. Yeah. So you spoke to him about the film because you were a fan initially, is that right?
That's right, yeah. I sent him my work a few times, sent him some Freakwave comics, sent him... and then what happened was that I did... You asked me for my credits in TV and film. Okay. Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles. I then get hired by Lorne Michaels of Saturday Night Live fame to completely invent a world for the Coneheads, which is a sketch. All they had was two Coneheads on a chair, and I had to extrapolate an entire universe, Conehead shaped ships, you know, spaceships and all that stuff, right? So I did. I had a year on the Paramount in Hollywood. It was great fun. Got to meet Bill Murray, Dan Aykroyd, David Spade, all those, you know, those Adam Sandler, all those people. Yeah. Out with, right, so that was. I was now starting to get into the Hollywood groove, living there, and all the rest of it. I did Lost in Space, The Borrowers, what else? Highlander 2, which could have been great. Ended up as a piece of shit. Yeah. There's a reason for that as well, because of sometimes films get destroyed internally by producers.
Yeah.
Say a financier's money gets withdrawn and collapses right. The movie. Suddenly they've got to cut 20% from the film. You know, that sort of shit goes on all the time, right? So the Highlander 2 was the result of shady background financing, which then fell apart. I'm trying to think. I've done films that never got made. You know, you spend a year on something that doesn't get done. I was in Hollywood. I created the visuals, art directed a TV series called Reboot, which is significant for being the first long form computer animated thing ever made prior to preceding Toy Story.
Yeah, that was huge. I remember that was on ITV.
Yeah, Reboot was massive worldwide hit. Yeah. It was a huge hit around 100 countries, everything. So I controlled all the visuals. I embedded all the stuff. I ran the toys, the motion control games, the actual game itself. There was a video game made, Electronic Arts. So I was sort of running all that. I did another TV series after that called War Planets, which was a sort of Star Wars epic. So Braveheart in space, essentially. That was CGI as well. Right, so I did all that. Anyway, we did an episode of Reboot to pastiche The Road Warrior, and I sent it to George Miller in Australia with a little note on it saying, "Whatever happened to Mad Max?" And sent it to him just for a laugh, you know. Right, and they phoned me up a couple of months later saying, you know, what is that stuff? And I said, yeah, it's computer animation, because nobody had seen it before. It was brand new. Toy Story hadn't come out. Mm. And he said, listen, we're going to be in Hollywood, you know, next week. Any chance we can meet up? And I said, sure, I'll see you there, blah, blah. So I flew down to see him, and immediately hit it off. Should have been there for 10 minutes, ended up having lunch and was in there for about 3 hours just talking about, I'd seen everything he's done. From his first short through the Mad Max films, Babe, you know, Lorenzo's Oil, which is a really quick, a lot of his TV stuff. And, I knew his stuff very well because I like his work. And I'd spent a lot of time talking about Mad Max. And I said to him, the reason we got you here is that we think they're doing a Mad Max TV series. That's back in the days of Xena Warrior Princess, you know, those kind of. Pre-streaming cable. Yeah. Right. So he said, well, can we use computer animation, say, to build background villages rather than map paintings and all that stuff? I said, sure, yeah, of course you can. You can do bombed out skyscrapers, all that stuff, yeah. Right. So I said, but please don't do a TV series. Why don't you do a new Mad Max series TV movie? Because to me, Mad Max is a big screen event.
Yeah.
I'd love to see a new, please do a new Mad Max. He said, oh, I don't know, I said, but you're going to go all the trouble of doing a TV show. You might as well do a movie. I said, I've got a fantastic idea for you. And if you can use any of it, because I'm never going to make a Mad Max film, but you might, here's the story. And I just gave him the idea. And it basically was, Max goes through this blighted landscape with these, I thought the weather by then would have got really ridiculously bad, you know, with massive storms and all the rest of it. And eventually the story was that Max has got to deliver this package, otherwise they kill these settlers that he was with. He's got to go through this sort of, down this sort of horrible landscape, and then he gets to the final place, which is like a giant castle. It's run by this guy. Inside the package that Max has been protecting all the time, the guy is a little squirt silver cube, and the guy puts it in sunlight and it's solar activated and it pings open, and inside it is a little vial, and the guy then says, come out. And this young girl, age 14, steps from this room, and he's been keeping her sort of perfect, And then he says, this is pure sperm, and I'm going to breed her, because the idea was to set the movie in the extinction of the human race, you know, in the extinction level event that the human race goes through. And that hence everybody has cancers and bad teeth, and they're all dying. All the kids are now dying at, you know, age 20 and all that stuff. So that's what I pitched him, and that's what became Fury Road. But he then, on the airplane flight back, thought it actually the girls should be girls, not one. And then suddenly he's got, and the person looking after the girl should be a woman, otherwise they'd try and fuck him. So the guardian and the girl brings the girls, and she's going back to this place, and then Max gets caught up in it because he needs their truck, but he's also got a pulled an armada on his back as well. So that's what George came up with on the flight back from me pitching in the idea. He then phones me up a month later and says, listen, I've been thinking about Mad Max and I'm really excited. Would you like to come over and sort of like help me, you know, just work the story? I said no. I said, no, of course I said yes. And so I finished up with, you know, Mainframe, who the company made Reboot and all that stuff, and then sorted everything out there. Then went over to work with George and just started the initial work on I remember the first day we sat down, we went out and I was really jet lagged because, you know, the flight to Australia really does your head in. And we just went out and had a coffee. I said, George, I just need a coffee to stay awake. And he goes, listen, I've got two ideas for the title. I've got Fury Road or Furiosa. What do you reckon? I said, it's got to be Fury Road. Because I thought Furiosa was a bit too sort of like a little bit too, what can I call, sort of frilly or poncy or something. Whereas Fury Road. And back then, the word fury hadn't been in titles like Fast and Furious and you know, all that stuff. It wasn't an overused word. It was a new word. So I said, Fury Road's fantastic, and it describes the journey down that road, you know.
Yeah.
So we what was strange is for the entire 2 years that me and George wrote that film, we called Charlize's Theron character the Warrior Woman, or the I can't remember, the Praetorian, that was it. And we that was standing in front of us like a low-hanging fruit, and neither of us spotted it till somebody else came in and said, what's her name? I said, well, she's the, they said, well, who's Furiosa? And they said, well, that's the name of the landscape that the Fury Road goes through. And then suddenly George clicked, of course, it's her name. You know, and it's amazing how stuff like that happens.
Yeah.
So, I mean, that film is basically a panel of yours made life. Do you mean the guy playing the guitar on the front of the lorry and, you know, this sort of thing? It just smacks of your stuff. You must have spent countless hours designing characters for that, though, did you?
Oh, yeah. I mean, I was the original writer, and I was credited as co-writer and production designer.
Right.
But the film went down three times, and I just couldn't stay available. Mm. And also, as I started getting more into the reality of production designing a huge Hollywood movie, which I hadn't done. You have no idea. It's most of your time's taken up ordering, trying to find sort of retro cars in car dumps in South Africa, which can be transported to Namibia to a workshop that you just set up. And now you've got to recruit internationally loads of engineers, all that shit, right? And I thought, I'm not interested in this. I'm just interested in what it looks like. And so in the end, I said, George, I'm going to withdraw from production designing this. You've got all my designs here. You've got, so everything in Fury Road, like hot rods, youth cult, spraying the teeth, the spiky cars with the saws, the guys who were the track bike riders, right? All that's me. All that sort of stuff was me. George left that all to me, where he focused on Furiosa and the girls and the whole, that side of it. So he was doing all that, and I was delivering him thrills and spills. And the thing that nobody ever talks about, I've never seen him once asked or me, which is the design of, if you like, the thrill ride itself. You know, the roller coaster of the movie.
Yeah.
You know,
when
you go into the film and you've got your coat there and your little side rest and your back popcorn, the curtains open and you settle down and you're off. You know that feeling of a good movie that's going to take you somewhere?
Yeah.
And go and you start and we crank you, and then you're off and then you're on. And that first, say, 40-minute sequence, you know, where he gets captured, finds the citadel, escapes.
That's a hell of a chase scene, isn't it?
Trapped to the front of the hot rods.
Yeah.
All that continuous sequence. And George has this idea of the cannon, The canon is where you set up an action sequence and then you canon it up to the next level and then you canon again to the next level. So if you see, it goes through three stages. It goes through getting caught, escape, you know, getting caught and then run through the catacombs. Then he's strapped to the front of a hot rod. Then the buzzsaw vehicles attack and then the storm comes and then it fades to black on the fizzling stick, you know. That whole thing is one giant canon sequence, and I had lots to do with that. That's really the Brendan McCarthy sequence.
Oh, nice.
I mean that whole film is just. I think there's only 1 5-minute period of that film where it takes a breath.
But you got, and also as I said about the roller coaster construct. Yeah. When you go on a roller coaster, you have to be cranked up. Then you go on the massive dip, and it's fuck me. But then you're going to get right up again for an even bigger one. And if it's and then there should be another third one as well. And that's how we structured the 3-act structure.
Yeah.
Right. Okay.
The first one is like, fuck me, my head scrambled after that. Yeah. And then the second one is slow build again. You've got to do the character work where he sees the girls washing, and then there's the physical fight, the negotiation to take over the truck, the armada bearing down, and then the tension's unbearable. Now they've got to blow the canyon. Now you're into the next sequence, and then we crank that up. And after you're out of that sequence, there's a time of rest where the movie pivots and they decide to go back. And that's where they're looking up at the satellites and everybody had a show.
To me, that's the pause at the top of the roller coaster where you're just waiting for it to tip over the end.
Well,
them ride down, you know, when they say, okay, let's go. And then they actually, the truck actually slides down the hill.
And
then two separated armadas start coming together to chase them. I mean, we literally did, you know, actually allude to a roller coaster ride with them actually going down the hill to then crank into the and final chase. And the final chase obviously has to be the best one, and there's lots of payoffs then in the chase that are emotional and plot payoffs buried inside the action. The thing about the third chase is there's a bit in the movie where I think the film slightly skids its wheels a bit, which is when they start huffing that petrol and then they fire the harpoons at the back to try and slow the truck down. That bit I felt slightly, I was thinking, the audience is thinking, oh, not all this stuff again. And it's only when the guys on the poles come in, suddenly everything lifts again and suddenly you're on, because we brought in something brand new. There's a point in the film, you see every movie, where the audience thinks, oh, I know what's roughly in this film now. And then you've got to deliver something that knocks them sideways and suddenly, hang on a minute, whoa, what's going on? And suddenly in come the guys on the poles and then the chase really takes off.
Yeah.
So effectively, I would actually have cut down that whole sequence before they come in.
Well, who is a massive fan of this film, I didn't think I'd ever be in a position where I'm sitting down talking to someone that has something to do with Mad Max Fury Road.
Yeah, yeah.
So I just want to say thank you, because that film is one of my favourites. So,
I kind of thought, I'm never going to top this film in a film career. So I sort of, after that, I kind of went back into comics again. I just thought, that's a nice one to
It's a movie that is constantly talked about still, isn't it? I mean, it's, even years after its release, it's still up all the time.
Just like Dan O'Bannon did his, what did he do, basically? He did Alien and The Long Tomorrow with Mobius. There is two pieces of work which have given him that canon status, you know.
Mm. Yeah.
You know, the canon sci-fi films, say, in the last 40, 50 years, you know, Blade Runner, first two Star Wars, Alien, Aliens, Matrix. I think Mad Max Fury Road joins the canon. You know,
I think you're right, man. And it was a bit of a forgotten trilogy. I mean, we live in a world of constant Predator movies and all this sort of crap.
Yeah,
but
exactly.
Mad Max was never returned to, almost, wasn't
exactly.
it?
Exactly. Yeah. No, that's exactly. You're almost repeating my conversation with George. I said Mad Max is a pristine franchise from the 80s. That hasn't had loads of crappy sequels. And even though Thunderdome, to my mind, was a problematical film, it didn't quite work. It still had tons of great stuff in it, just didn't have the raw.
I wonder if that was because you got all those Italian rip-offs of it. You know, you got the New Barbarians, and you got loads of movies that came out post Road Warrior, didn't they? That were, rips of it almost.
a lot of it was to do with George Miller.
Right.
You got to understand, he was a kind of guerrilla filmmaker. He'd done Mad Max 1 for something like $300,000. And it, until Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles, which was an interesting conversation I had with him when I first met him, Mad Max 1 held the record for cost-to-profit ratio.
Okay.
It cost $300,000, but it made over $100 million because it was huge in Japan, France, places like that. So then Ninja Turtles came along and blew Mad Max out. And so, you know, we had an interesting conversation about, you know, things we had in common, like me knocking the number one spot. what were we saying about...
So you went from Hollywood, you've come back to comics, which I think is a great segue to talk about Zorcerer of Zilk.
Oh, yeah.
For those who don't know what that is, tell us what exactly is Zorcerer of Zilk, and I'm amazed I managed to say it correctly three times in a row. So.
Well, the Zorcerer of Zilk, I remember one night just wrote Zorcerer of Zilk down, just as a laugh, because it made me laugh, because it was Sorcerer of Milk. Right, you know, I was Zorcerer of Zilk. You know when you just write stupid crap down? I do. Anyway.
Yeah.
I have sketchbooks and I write and draw in them all the time, and sometimes you look back on an idea 10 years later and you think, fuck, that's really good, and then up it goes. So it was just a little word, phrase written down, and from that I just thought, I want to do a really good sort of like glam rock David Bowie looking Doctor Strange kind of character. That's what I want.
Okay.
And so visually I played with his costume. I was thinking of Brian, you know, Brian Jones from the Rolling Stones. Do you know that guy?
Yeah.
He had that kind of, he used to have sort of panda eyes and then long blonde hair, kind of in a page boyish type cut. And I thought something a bit like that is what I had in mind when I designed Zorcerer of Zilk. But I wanted to add bits like Frankenfurter stockings and, you know, high, you know, glam rock boots. And, you know, but so there's an element, Spider-Man's front V-shaped thing or Elizabethan shoulder pads. So it was a postmodern kind of superhero, kind of wizard costume. With a character, sometimes I think if I've got a strong visual, then I can extrapolate from that a good story or a good world, a universe. So then I built the universe of the Zorcerer of Zilk first. And I thought, this is a good universe. I've got the supporting characters. I've got the sort of the manor house he lives in that's made out of curtains, that's always fluttering, you know, all that kind of stuff. So I did want to do something quite imaginative, because I've got a thing about I think imaginism, or the imaginist movement in comics, which I've just founded now, I'm seeing a bit of that going on. If you look at Grant Morrison's Green Lantern, it's very he's using imagination as the strong rather than gritty realism, for example.
Okay.
Do you see what I mean?
Yeah.
So I wanted to do a piece of art that was of the imagination. That I thought that was the thing that comics doesn't do much. It always tends to do, you know, future dystopias, which I'm incredibly bored with, having obviously done Mad Max. But I feel like I've got it out of my system.
Yeah.
So anyway, I wanted to do something very imaginative. I looked at Yellow Submarine, a film to this day that still staggers and astonishes me. It was done in a year, made for £1 million, and it's the design of the film that holds it together, and of course the soundtrack, rather than the animation, which is the only thing to shout about. But it's the design is so amazing. That's what keeps it, holds
it
together.
It's instantly recognisable, that design, isn't it? It still is.
Yeah, yeah, it's fantastic. Heinz Edelman was the guy.
Okay.
And, so those are the elements around Zorcerer of Zilk. So I thought I needed to work with a writer, and I felt like I want to work with somebody new. I'd worked with Al Ewing on, I'd suggested a Judge Dredd story to Tharg about Doctor Who, called Doctor What, to take, about a travelling porta potty. Guy gets trapped in it, you know. It's just that really I was just trying to get a rise out of Whovians, and they got Al Ewing to write it, and he did a great job, and it was actually an actual funny script, because very few scripts are funny. So Matt asked Al would he be interested in working with me on a collaborative basis, and Matt, you know, he just said yeah, all right, why not. So we just sort of talked about it and knocked it about, and Al kind of then brought in other elements in the first Zorcerer of Zilk series, which came out 7 years ago now, which is amazing.
Wow. Okay. Yeah.
We fused our ideas together, and hence it says created by us two. And So roll it on 7 years later. I got an idea. I thought, you know, I'd like to roll those characters out again. So I asked Matt, do you fancy doing another Zorsa Resort at all? Because I've got some, you know, I just finished Dream Gang for Dark Horse Comics.
Yeah, yeah.
And wanted to do something new. And he said, oh, great, yeah. And Al wasn't available because he's now gone supernova with the Hulk or something. Mm. So, yeah, I think he wanted to do it, but he just was, you know, he might have one of those exclusive contracts.
He's hip deep in events now, that boy, isn't he? Mm. You know what I mean? Yeah.
Yeah, I hear that he's doing really well, which is fantastic. Yeah. So Matt suggested Peter Hogan.
Okay.
And I thought, oh, Peter, you know, he used to be the editor of Revolver, the...
which was a marvellous magazine, which... Rogan got. Forgotten. Yeah.
So I knew Peter by telephone more than person. Anyway, so I had a vague idea for a story. Again, you know, just this is, I want this sort of stuff to happen, and this is what the theme is. What do you think? And he said, oh, yeah, and then you could do that and that. And then suddenly we had the story sussed out in about 5 minutes. And then, you know, we talked about it a bit more. And then what usually happens is once we've worked the story out, that bit to me is the most important stuff. Pete goes off, not Pete, Peter, yeah, it is Peter Hogan. Yeah, Peter Hogan goes off and writes his script. I go to the art. You know, in the end, he has jurisdiction over the script and I have jurisdiction over the art. So, you know, now and then, if I got a script from him and I think, actually, this bit doesn't quite make sense compared to the bit we did, or it's repeating the bit we did, they don't need all that dialogue, I'll just write to him and say, listen, I don't think you need all this stuff, or can I have an extra panel here where this happens because we need to set that up for later, you know, all that kind of stuff, just technical stuff.
Yeah,
so we do a bit of that anyway, so it's all very straightforward once the rhythm's up and we're going along with it. Fine. Now the first one with Al was a bit more sort of I feel it was a bit more of a feels like Teen Spirit sort of Nirvana type comic, you know, it had a bit more, you know, it was a bit sort of Northern depressive stuff, courtesy of Al, and it had a bit more of that kind of Morrissey-esque sort of, and then you find yourself alone in an old people's home and where does your life go? I thought, okay, this is fun, and we understand that it's sort of slightly tongue-in-cheek moroseness, but this one's a bit more, you know, a bit more, I called it more of a groove. It's a bit more fun. All the characters have been established, so we don't have to do all that hard work of setting them up. We can just play with them a bit more. So I just brought back a lot of characters that I liked, and now they're easy to do, you know.
Oh, nice.
Yeah.
So it started in the Christmas special, didn't it? And it's still running at the moment, isn't it? I'm right in saying.
12 pages in the Christmas special. I thought it looked very nice in print.
Looked great, man, yeah. Yeah.
Yeah.
And it starts off with...
I thought Zorsha Zilk and Henry Flint's new one, was it? Something, Proteus Vex.
Yeah.
I thought they worked really well together. Yeah. I thought, this is looking like heavy metal or Metal Hurlant or something. You know, this. I actually thought it was a genuinely good issue, that, wasn't it? You know, Christmas issue. We actually had about five good strips, cut the turkeys, but, you know, 2008 was always
That's
like
an
that.
Anthology for you, though, dude. We talk a lot about anthologies, and it's often a mixed bag, isn't it? You're lucky if there's three things you really dig in it, you know?
Oh, look, when I used to read 2008, I'd skip half of it. You know, I'd never read... There was things I'd never read, like Harlem's Heroes. I thought, I have no interest in anything to do with sports, so that would be off, you know? There's things, you know, things I couldn't be asked reading, you know, and there's other ones where, I mean, honestly, there's certain artists drew dread. I couldn't even read it. The art is off. I can't do it.
Mm.
Yeah.
So is Zorsha of Zilk, is that the sort of your focus at the moment, or is that all finished but about to be published? Is it in the bag?
Yes, it's Zorsha of Zilk. I'm just, we're just awaiting Len's final colours for the last episode. And then what happens is Len... I do the black and white, send it to Len. Len colours it, and it comes back to me. And then I, if you like, remix it and add the sort of pop video, sort of choppy, sort of zappy effects into things. And, you know, I might remix a panel to make it more contrasted, or I might change the gutter backgrounds to make them, you know, less dark and brighten them up because I think it's getting a bit gloomy here. It should be brighter, you know. So... You know, I then give it a final polish. I also do colour corrections if he's coloured the Zorsa's helmet the wrong colours. You know, anything like that, I'll pick that stuff up.
For those that haven't seen your work, Brendan, colour's a huge part of your...
Yeah,
especially now that you've turned... I'm guessing you're fully digital, are you now?
Well, I am well. So I still draw black and white on paper.
Right. Okay.
Scan
right.
it in. I don't. I found the Wacom thing can make you put over detail stuff. I think a mark of an immature artist is over detailing.
Right.
You know, when you look at stuff that has just detail crammed in every corner, you think, get off the Wacom and do something else, because Wacom could drag you into blowing up little half-inch areas and filling it full of crowds or something, and you think, this will make, there'll be a balloon stuck over that. Anyway, you know? So I've learned, I'm very attracted to artists like Joe Kubert, Hugo Pratt, people like that, who develop a kind of Zen brush simplicity to their work. I'm hoping I'll never get to that because I don't do it enough, and plus one of the big things about taking a 15-year break from drawing comics and doing that is you lose your mojo. And it's taken me really 10 years since I came back into comics to really, I feel that this Zorza Resort is my best piece so far.
Right.
You know, the other stuff,
great, man. Food,
A little bit patchy here and there where I've lost, you know, I've lost it. I can't draw the position that I used to be able to draw. Like the thing, it's just like a muscle. Once you stop doing it, it's like a, once you get out of the game, it's very hard to come back into the game and be any good. So what I've had to do is change my style. Also, the digital has really changed stuff. I've never been an artist that's naturally gifted with talent. Like, say, somebody like Simon Bisley, say. Now, that guy's a natural talent.
I don't know about this, Brent. I watched you draw a few lines at Bristol once, and I was, like, blown away, man. There's,
I'm not being sort of... you know, fake humility.
Okay.
I'm part of the deal of being a professional is you look at the market and you judge where you are in the market. So I think, okay, I'm not going to be able to compete with people like Bisley or, you know, these types of guys on technical wizardry. What I can compete with them on is creativity. So I feel that my work, bang for buck, is really super creative, that there's a lot of inventiveness, innovation, new thought, original thought in my stuff, and I'm selling that, and I'm using my art to get that across.
Yeah.
So, you know, so you've got to know really what your strengths are and what your weaknesses are. And I tend to obviously got to play with my strengths, which I think is originality and, you know, and also the use of colour, as you say.
Well, another strength of yours is you're a bloody good guest to have on a podcast. So,
I actually sent you on a message, it won't be an hour, just around about an hour. And you said to me,
yeah, it's blasted.
Sorry, guys. Is that me gassing on? I'm really
not at all.
That is what we want.
That was brilliant.
But for those who want to check out, like, you know, Zorza of Zilk or what you've got upcoming, or where they can find out more about, like, your work, or I don't know if you're going to do any conventions, or, you know, where can people find out more about your work and stuff?
Right. By 2000 AD, because the Zorza of Zilk is running in it for the next 10 weeks.
Oh, wow.
That's one thing you can do. You can just follow the story of the Zorza Zilk, which is a kind of David Bowie meets Harry Potter type wizards strip.
Well, that'll sell a lot of people, line just there.
Exactly.
I have a website, which I haven't maintained for a while now, but still there's a load of stuff up on it if you just want to look at Mad Max production art, things like that. It's called artbrendan.com. Easy one to remember.
Yeah.
And... I'm finished with the Zorza Resort, and on Monday, tomorrow, I'm about to start a new short little strip I created for 2000 AD called Knacker of the Stars, which is basically a touch of frost meets Dan Dare. So it's it's about a Arthur Lowe-style grumpy detective set in a 1950s-type Britain with, you know, with gyro cars and fin-shaped spaceships.
Amazing.
It's a bit of fun. And
writing and drawing, and I totally you
worked the story out, and Roger Langridge and I then
love Roger.
Further. Again, Matt suggested Roger because he's a kind of, he's written humor stuff of his, I think, and, you know, whatever. And exactly. And so Roger then sort of understands that kind of world of the you know, the sort of bullheaded Arthur Lowe type, you know those old characters from the 1950s. So it's a sort of retro sci-fi detective, space detective, who's rather grumpy, and there's lots of 1950s type robotic vicars and, you know, all that stuff. So it's very
interesting
style, just a bit of fun. I just want to try the character out. So it's a short three-parter. And it's an Agatha Christie type story, a whodunit.
So for the Frog or for the magazine?
That'll be for the prog.
Right, brilliant. Yeah.
Okay. And a couple of new concepts. The only difficulty with coming up with stuff for 2000 AD and Rebellion is they don't allow you to own your own material. And I haven't given them the Zorta result and this one. I'm where, you know, anything really fucking shit hot I've got, I'd rather probably do it with Dark Horse or something like that, where I keep the copyright. Because it's all big.
Dream Gang, didn't you? Yeah.
Now
it's
very big business.
Yeah. Well, keep us posted of anything and everything you do.
Super.
Are you connected to Comic Scene, or what's the...
We're all connected in some way.
Yeah. We didn't win the award. It was stolen from us. Yeah.
It's not about awards, Tony. It's never about awards.
Never. Yeah. We know them a little bit, for sort of just from the scene, really, to be fair. Yeah.
Okay, so I thought you might be the official podcast of the comic of the magazine.
No, I think they've got their own one, which is something to do with Dundee Uni, I think. Yeah. We're friends with John Freeman and Down the Tubes.
He's good. He's great. Yeah, he's good.
Top guy. Yeah, love him. Yeah.
I'm glad. I'm really enjoying just getting back into British comics again. Actually, there's. I mean, I've spent the last 5 years studying Alfred Bestel. You know, the Rupert artist.
Okay.
I think.
Could we see? Could we see it at Thought Bubble 1 year? Maybe.
I don't know. The only thing about those comic conventions, number one, I very rarely get invited, and secondly. Yeah, because you mentioned that incident from 5 years ago where some guy did some hit piece on me.
Right. Okay.
That completely changed the perspective of me in that kind of indie scene. Suddenly, I was comic book Hitler. So that's dried up all that stuff. The other thing is, as well is, you take a weekend. I live in a different country. By the time you've ranked up all your costs and expenses, you're out of pocket. You don't make any money. And basically, it's a bunch of people saying, can you draw Judge Dredd? And they have no interest in anything else you've done. So, I don't get a lot out of them, honestly.
Okay. All right.
The right one I go to, though, I'd go to the right one.
Tuned then.
I think Thought Bubble would be good. I think it'd be good for you, man. I really do. Yeah.
And thank you very much for this, Brennan.
A pleasure.
It's been amazing.
It's an hour and fuck me, it's nearly you.
Just blasted by.
Yeah.
Yeah.
That's what happens. Look at that, eh?
Oh man,
yeah,
that's exciting.
That was a good one. That was very good. Thank you, Brendan. Thank you again, Brendan, for joining us and talking. Obviously, like, there are a lot of toothers out there probably listening to the show that have already checked out Zorcerer Zilk.
Yep.
I'd love to if we could get Brendan on again maybe later in the year and talk about his creative process.
Which we didn't really touch enough on.
There was a few things there was that we were planning to talk about, but then you suddenly realise that there's a Pandora's box of awesome comic stories and information, and you think, this is going to be, there's going to have to be a part two to this somewhere. For instance,
learn a word though. Was it didactic?
Yeah, didactic. As well. He's a clever guy, isn't he?
Never come across that one. So
you
that's
love learning words, don't you, Dan?
I've heard him talk a lot about the difference between film and comics as well, and that is a really interesting subject when you get him started on that, because he obviously is the master of both.
And they're very different ways of thinking, even though, I certainly, a shorthand for me to talk about a comic book that I've read is sometimes to say it's cinematic. I know a lot of our listeners will probably, I say it every week probably.
But from a single image sometimes, but from the point of view of a moving image, and he talks a lot about sound effects and the sound effects taking place in someone's head. Which is really interesting, you know. We need to get him back on. We'll get him back on for the next thing, I guarantee.
So, we hope you enjoyed that. And, of course, we've still got some recommendations. But before that, what shout-outs do we have this week, gents?
I've got a couple. So, first off, Mr. Cumber. I had lunch with Mr. Cumber in the Wilds of Cornwall just the other day, and he was great.
Cliffy
company. Cliffy Cumber. And, we had an absolute fucking blast. Although he did try and sexually assault a seagull, which is all right. I didn't mind. So it's good seeing him. And the new comic's on its way. I promise it's looking ace. Big shout out to Stuart McCune, who sent me a care package of a load of Dylan dogs. Italian Dylan dogs look brilliant. Thanks, Stu. Love Stu's work, and he's good pal of ours. New penned Gwyn book, Vision, has dropped on Kickstarter. Get on it. We love Mr. Henderson's book, don't we? We're big fans of it.
He was my Thought Bubble bro.
He was. Yeah, he was. And if there's ever a brilliant toilet read, it's Penguin. And I've said that to his face. And
yeah.
He's
no, fine. No, yeah, like, yeah. Yeah.
And my last one is keep your eyes out. January 29th, Atomic Hercules is dropping on Kickstarter.
Yes. Yes.
About. I'm going to use the phrase, keep your eye out, Cocker.
And I'm going to say this. You are not prepared for what you're going to...
I'm just writing issue 2, and it gets worse.
Yeah, yeah.
Can I do a quick shout-out for John Tucker? He's got his next book coming out, Troops, in about 3 weeks' time. And you can pre-order it from him on his site, and you get some behind-the-scenes commentary.
Audio commentary, yeah.
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 And that's knowing John, that's well worth getting. So yeah. And
I think his videos alone have shifted copies of that that book, haven't they?
Yeah.
The bit where he just turns the camera and he's pointing at his temple.
Yeah.
Same thing.
Or like the comic will make you, what was it, think so hard you'll lose a tooth or something like that. Yeah.
Good stuff.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, brilliant stuff. And speaking of True Believers, True Believers is kicking off 2020 convention season for us. It's taking place on the Saturday, the 1st of February, in Jury's Inn in Cheltenham between 10:30 a.m. and 5 p.m. Go to oktruebelievers.com to find out more. There's tons of indie sort of creators and just amazing people that are going to be there. And me and Dan are going to be there as well.
Oh, yeah.
Tony is jet setting. He's being our.
Well, if I know we've got a couple of listeners going to Onglim. If you're at Onglim, come say hi. I shall be hobnobbing it. I'll probably just be hanging around the Europe Comic stand.
Are you going to have a packet of hobnobs?
Undoubtedly.
Lovely.
Yeah.
Plain or chocolate?
Well, chocolate's no good for the biscuit game, isn't it? So probably just plain.
What do you mean it's no big... Oh.
you know what?
I suddenly realised what he's talking about. And I think it's best we move on.
Public school boy. Okay, yeah. Moving on.
Moving on. Yeah, so please come along to the weekend of True Believers because it's going to be brilliant. So, without further ado, we've got a couple of recommendations this week before we set you off into the sunset.
Yeah.
Who wants to go first?
Well, you go first, V. I'm interested in hearing the one. I keep meaning to read this and I'll go around to it, yeah.
Well, this is the one I'm going to talk about is actually from, as I said earlier in the show, it is on Comic House available at the moment. It's also available on Comixology. There's also Gumroad as well. But this is a series by a creator who is rapidly becoming one of my favourite creators, actually.
Oh.
There's just something, you know, when you just connect with like artwork and just storytelling and, you know, you can't really put it into words so much, but it's just... Yeah, so whatever they release, I'm going to be up for reading. And this is the series Lost Time by JWC, who is at JWC on Twitter. This is a series that I spoke about once before. I think issue 3, which is called Menagerie. Do you remember I talked about that issue and the way, like, the panels and storytelling and, you know, dreamlike? And do you remember that it was very green?
Yeah, I think so. It's almost like there's a stained glass effect to some of the work, is that right?
Yeah. And this series, Lost Time, is an anthology series. There's 7 issues of it which are all available now. The creator, I presume you are female. Apologies if you're not, but they released the entire series in 2019. Looking back, I saw it on Twitter. They said, looking back on 2019, the thing I'm most proud of is finally releasing Lost Time. There were many moments where I thought that it might be better just to keep it to myself, but I'm glad the series is out.
Okay.
Which is interesting. And I'm
that is interesting.
I'm very glad the series is out because it's an anthology series. Like, there's 7 issues and they're different sort of stories. You know, that there was there's dreamlike stories, there's some dark stuff, there's some real sort of slice of life poignant storytelling going on. I recommend all of them because there is going to be something for everyone, and they're all entire, like, beginning, middle and end. You know, each issue is an entire tale, and there's going to be an issue for someone. But the one that I wanted to talk about now, which is my favorite of the series, was issue 4. You don't have to read these in any order. You know, that's the beauty of this kind of series, you know, and it just is what it is. The Sun and the Air. Now, this is a story that's more more down to earth. It's more of a real life, slice of life sort of tale. about a guy, basically just a guy called Wes, who's just in a sort of, he's in a Volkswagen van, just traveling across the deserts, you know, just, where is he going? He doesn't really know. He's basically traveling to nowhere. And he's got things on his mind. And he picks up a hitchhiker. And then the hitchhiker's basically heading towards the sea. That's basically what it is. But they're just, it's, and then you have like an issue, which is like a story of like strangers who become friends, and just, the best way to describe it is, it's hard to describe because it's a beautifully visual story, this one. I've mentioned before that Jay actually plays with panel layout and design. We said that there's like you say, there's almost been like a stained glass,
yeah,
sort of. And this goes through the entire anthology series, but you know, and this issue also has that. There's wonderful sort of curved panels. There's Art Deco shapes, which is very interesting to use those sort of shapes in and essentially, you know, something that could have been standard panels. It could have been normal, yeah, storytelling, but it just makes me stare at the pages even more. You know, I will say with this series, Lost Time, they change up the art style on every story, which I think is quite interesting for an indie creator. It's almost like every story has its own sort of atmosphere or theme. And maybe it could be a case of, I want to experiment with a different type of art style for this potential story. So some may work better than others. You know, there's some that I might think are better than others, but you know, we've all got different sort of tastes and flavors. But I would say that issue 4 was my favorite in terms of art. It just felt complete. It's almost painterly. I think it's a digital style. I want to say it's a digital style. But because you're dealing with, you know, the sun and deserts and the ocean, there's a wonderful sort of orange hue going through this, orange and blue, and you know, just the whole atmosphere of the book itself has that. And it gets, we spoke when I first mentioned the creator's art, and I know they're a listener, so hello. Yeah. because I first came to the attention of their artwork with the Citric arc, which I mentioned a while ago as well, which is also on Comic House. And I mentioned then about like the lettering, you know, maybe could use a bit of work. And I've noticed just when you see a creator just evolving and moving on and just progressing, and it's wonderful to see. And especially in this series, I think it's quite brave actually to have 7 completely different stories and try 7 different ways of telling them in terms of art. I wouldn't know how to do that, because I'd be afraid of, because I don't know about you guys, but I slip into the art styles and the habits that I
definitely,
yeah,
okay,
yeah. So
you mean you find them accidentally, you mean, or
there are times when I think I'm going to try drawing this more seriously, you know, this is going to be more realistic, but it just ends up slipping back into this, my natural sort of my style, almost cartoony animation sort of style.
Okay.
You know, I know when I did Murder Road, the first panel of that, I was going to do it like super heavy blacks, and then it just became something else, which was just easier to draw and also more fun to draw.
Yeah.
So huge respect to someone that's really experimenting and trying something different. And I think in terms of the stories, there's a real there's a depth there. There's a real emotive storytelling that comes from personal interaction between people. And I think that's the best way. With these books, it's less about making you, you know, hitting you in an emotional level because of a huge sort of, you know, maybe you're talking about a huge political statement or something. It's less about those sort of emotive moments. It's more about the real personal, dealing with grief or you know, just feeling lost, or you know, and those stories like that, I find that they really hit me in this series.
Okay.
And you know, there is sadness. A lot of them are tinged with sadness, but there's moments of joy. And you know, there's a lightness of touch, and even when there's some of the books, I'm trying to say stuff without spoiling anything, because I literally was looking forward to all of these. I waited for these all to basically queue up, and I spent like a Saturday just reading just the Lost Time series. And not knowing anything about them, it was wonderful to discover, you know, how things emotionally touched me. And The Sun in the Air was the one that really like touched me quite emotionally, especially with the ending. It's a sad happiness, which I love to the ending. I mean, I'm murdering this recommendation, but it's purely because because I want people to check out all of these books and see them for themselves, because it really is a great little series of books. Purely from a design perspective, just check out what she does with the panels and the wonderful sort of panel frames and stuff. I love all that. So I'm looking forward to seeing what the creator does in this year, and it'd be interesting to see, you know, might have to get them on the show to talk about it, because with some of the themes that go on in this book, it's not like someone's being supremely autobiographical. They feel autobiographical, but these can't be, you know, it's not the creator. I know it's not the creator. So how do you
case of good writing, you mean?
How do you get yourself in that position to tell something that feels supremely autobiographical when it's clearly not you? That's a bit special in terms of writing, I think. Check out Lost Time at JWC on Twitter. Not more people need to check out these books, and they're clearly humble, because they were going to keep all these books to themselves. So it's clearly a personal work, which is what we like to see on the show anyway.
Yeah,
and speaks for itself. So find it on Comic House. It's on Comixology if that's how you read your comics. I would love to see something like this. Sort of collect it, you know, if there was a print collection at some point, somehow, some way, you know, on Kickstarter or something, it'd just be nice to have a book like this in the collection. But I mean, it's 7 issues and they're all like 29, 30 pages each. To release that in a year, that's fair play in itself.
Yeah.
That's very good. So, so check out.
I like to refer to that as doing a butcher.
yeah, that's like stepping into beast mode, isn't it, like Butcher does on a daily basis. Yeah. But yeah, check out Lost Time and JWC.
The Beast of Broadstairs, as I like to call it now.
Yeah. Okay, the highest recommendation from me. So yeah. Who's next?
Oh. Do you want to go, Dan?
Yeah, I can go. I was originally going to talk about a Moon Knight book, which was enjoyable enough, but it wasn't really that great. The tone kind of goes all over the place. One minute it wants to be serious, the next minute it's kind of dropping, like tries to be funny, which I don't know. it wasn't right, the balance. But Vince pointed out this comic, which I checked out, called Badass.
When you see a comic and you just think, I think Dan Butcher's going to like this.
Yeah.
Purely based on the title, I would recommend that one to him. Yeah.
And it stands for the Bureau of Alien Detection and Supernatural Sightings. It's written, drawn, coloured, led by one chap called Adrian Nelson, and it's on Comixology for ridiculously cheap. The artwork's absolutely gorgeous. It's kind of one of those styles that I always wish I could kind of do. It's, you know, that chap who originally drew Walking Dead, Tony Moore.
Yeah,
it's kind of got a bit of that, but with more of a kind of an Eastern influence on it. It's all kind of harsh black and whites with a bit of red where there's blood, and like a half tone pattern that he's kind of worked in, so you kind of get the grey dots. He's built up tone and shadow. The story is a bit so-so. It feels like a 90s Image comic.
Yeah,
right.
Like very much like that, where there's an idea there that needed more fleshing out and more rendering and getting to the nub of what the idea is and making it stronger. But essentially, it's like a kind of a team of super special operatives who are kind of like sent on these missions. And this one is to sort of fight a living sort of pathogen, which is very thing from The Thing, basically, very similar to that.
Okay.
And the first issue ends on a cliffhanger where they think they've kind of contained it, but it appears far from that. And you get the story from the rookie's kind of like initially just joined the team, and they all start coming together. So if you like Image, 90s Image comics with banging art, I would check it out. And you can't, for 69p, You can't really go wrong.
And it's a one-man band as well, isn't it? It's Adrian Nelson's done it all himself, I think.
So, you can't really go on with that.
Yeah.
So,
hopefully there'll be an issue too at some point, see where it goes.
Well, this was, I was checking, this came out, I think, in 2017.
Oh, did it? Okay.
Well, there's a drawing here that says the front cover's got the drawing 2017, and so is the one in the inside. So I'm not sure how long.
It's only just hit Comixology, or maybe it was on, you know.
Maybe it's been out for a while, but they've not.
Yeah.
There was one comic I reviewed ages ago on the show called Bums. Do you remember that?
Yeah.
By a guy named Joseph Discella. And I thought, like, this is going to be the one and only comic we see from Joseph. But Bums issue 2's out. So,
are you happy there's more Bums out there?
We're always happy for extra Bums.
You want to check out more Bums, do you, Dan?
That's another one with the iron art is absolutely dynamite, but like there's a whole issue where virtually nothing happens.
Yeah.
And you're like, oh, okay. It's
it's an artist like issue.
Yeah, it's like a kind of the main character gets followed down into the subway and then like he turns around and gets ready to kind of throw down. And that's like 25 pages.
Right. Okay.
Yeah, you really pulled that scene out. So there we go.
Cool.
Nice. Okay, Tony.
Mine's British Ice, which I know was a cover that we started doing our cover thing again this week.
We have indeed. Yeah.
And this was Vince's one of his four covers of the week.
Yeah.
British Ice.
Beautiful cover. Beautiful cover.
Lovely design to it. It's basically a break in an ice sheet. And in the shape of the Union Jack, and in the middle is a boat that breaks up the word British and ice. It's by Owen D. Pommery, who we're pals with. He's British stalwart. He did Between the Billboards, which I think off the top of my head was put up by Avery Hill. Is that right? I'm trying to remember. He's someone I've been chatting to him about this book for a couple of years. I know it's been in the works, and he's done the Top Shelf have done themselves proud by publishing it, and he's gone to Top Shelf, who are now, and I think they're owned by IDW, I'm going to say. Is that right? I think that's right. It's
sounds about right, yeah.
125 pages, $13.99 English, in dollars $14.99. It's black and white and bluey grey, sort of that combination of two-tone colours, which I quite like. Probably quite a wise colour choice, bearing in mind it's all about the Arctic. Harrison is from the naval stock, or good government working stock, and his father was something of a legend in the Foreign and Commonwealth Office, and he's called into the British High Commission by and to go to the Queen Elizabeth Islands in the Arctic, which is an island that I believe Owen has made up. But as part of the story, that is, he goes there in order to take control. It's a place that is notoriously quite a handful. It's bleak. It's cold. Well, obviously, very cold. And the indigenous people kind of. There's been an incident in the past. As he pulls up in the boat, he's watched arriving by a member of the local indigenous people, who just stares at him, walks off, and kind of that's for the first half of the book. That's how he's treated. He gets a very strange reception and is taken to the middle of nowhere, to what looks like a house that has been transported from Chelsea into the middle of the ice fields. And it's explained to him that it was going to be the start of a community, that they were going to start building houses similar to what they were used to in England. And it's this strange townhouse just in the middle of nowhere. He pulls a letter out from Captain J.H. Newton from 1882 that hints that there was something more to the island, something has happened. And the more he explores, by chatting to the people on the island, there's a helicopter pilot who arrives, who's kind of one of the few people there who will talk to him. And night comes and he hears a strange drumming noise. So it's got that Wicker Man weirdness to it, you know, but it's kind of set in the Arctic. And he opens the door and he finds the skeleton of a dead bird on his doorstep and no people there. He's told by the pilot it's easy to lose your perspective in all this white, and that's kind of a word that echoes through it. Turns out the indigenous people are superstitious, and they hint at a Wendigo. They hint at creatures and magic and mysticism. But he decides to pursue the mystery of why Netherton and his crew disappeared. And he works his way through various little bits of the story that jump out at you and you explore. And Owen does well. He takes the pace of it well, and it paces itself along with the mystery, if you see what I'm saying by that.
Yeah.
You talk about there being bad. He finds out there's bad blood. And this begins between the indigenous people and the settlers, or the imperialist, you know, occupiers of the island in a way. And it slowly, time passes very slowly. It took me quite a few pages before I noticed that the top left hand of each of the occasional page tells you what day you're on. So one might say day 4, and you go forward a few pages, day 22. It's if I was designing it, I'd probably make that slightly more discernible. It's not easily noticeable. It took me a few minutes because I was sort of caught, you get caught up in the story, don't you, and yeah. Following it. I didn't notice that. So that the passing of time is slightly more linear than I expected at the first read, but it's good for it. Owen's style is minimalistic in a way. He's not a big noodler. The faces are fairly iconic. There's no more than probably 10 lines on some of their faces, that sort of thing. But he makes them so distinct that you can tell who's who. You can tell what they're thinking or what they're feeling, and there's little sly looks away. He does the technique that we've seen occasionally in books of there's a couple of flashbacks. So once you get into about a halfway, maybe at the point in the book, there's a couple of flashbacks to what happened before. Once he's beginning to discover this mystery, and they're toned, the colour of them is slightly greyer, just to give you a sense of the flashback, which works well, and I think was a correct decision to make. I don't want to spoil it because it is a mystery of a book.
Okay.
At first, I suspected it might go to a mystic kind of magical monster way. And I don't think it's any spoilers, but it doesn't. It keeps it. I suppose the nearest book to it would maybe be Whiteout by Greg Rucker from a few years ago, if you read that. Similar sort of thing. There's a couple of moments you think, oh, dear, really? From a sort of, oh, dear, what's happened here? What's happening to him? He needs help. You know, that sort of thing. There's the usual, the radio's been broken. You know, the little moments like that that you got in the, you know, the easy touchstone for this would be the thing, but it's more personal than that. It's quieter than that. It's, I think he's an architect off the top of my head, Owen, and he manages the close-up well. He manages the conversations well. The dialogue's particularly well done, but he also manages when you pull the camera out and you get a much wider look at the landscape around him, this sort of bleak, cold landscape. The real cold is I suppose the ever pervading sinisterness of the freezing cold there is one of the main characters of the book, and then it's done really well. And the strangeness of the people and the ignorance of the fact they ignore him as he walks past them, and is there more to him than you think? He's a very likable everyman, the main character in Harrison, and that works well for it. It has a great ending. It ends well, which I won't spoil at all. And then you get a little epilogue which stretches it a little bit. You see something else happen. But there's a reason for all this, and the reason, as we all know, I won't ruin it, but there's a reason that we all know is behind everything in big business, really. But something happens, and I recommend it. It's nice to see Owen breaking out of the small press London scene and working with Top Shelf, and I know this has been a few years in the making, but it's a lovely little collection. It's got French flaps on it. It's a trade with a lovely spine to it, and it can sit well. It's a lovely designed spine to it. You know, where British ice, it touches the edge of the spine, if that makes sense, where it's written. So it's not just down the central middle of it. It's the length of the breadth of the spine, which works really well. I'd recommend it. I like Owen's work. He's a clever. He writes well. He writes people well, and he writes likable and understandable situations that make for a great reader. I read it in one sitting. It's 120 pages. I bought my copy in, I think you got your cover off of Comixology, didn't you?
Yes, it's available on Comixology this week.
So it's great that because it's with Top Shelf, it's straight away released on Comixology, it's straight away released in Diamond, and it's in comic shops now. So go to your comic shop and get it. British Ice by Owen. Good stuff. That's my one.
Nice. Yeah. So some great indie comics for you to check out there, and plenty of comics content this week, as always.
Oh, yeah.
This year is going to be more of the same. We've got some great shows lined up. So we hope you enjoy this episode, and if there's anything that maybe you want to know more about, or maybe we got something wrong, or maybe there's an event that you want us to talk about on the show, please let us know. Yeah. You can email us awesomecomicspod@gmail.com, and just, you know, even if you've got an upcoming book that you'd like us to see or check out, yeah, or, you know, just let us know. We've been sent a couple of things recently. So our to repile is always huge.
Yep.
Mm-hmm. And that's just the stuff we're sent as well. It's not always the stuff that we're buying as well.
Yeah.
But keep it all coming. If you go on Twitter, follow us on @TheAwesomePod, where we'll be announcing, we'll be retweeting people. We put a shout out for the True Believers this week. That anyone that's exhibiting there, just get on that thread and we'll retweet it and get the word out. Similarly with other things, get in touch with us on there. If you do the Book of Faces, go to facebook.com/awesomecomicspodcast. If you want to talk about comics on a weekly basis, but actually properly talk about comics, whether it be making them, conventions, or just anything in general, without any hard selling, without any nonsense, sometimes it's just a badass art thread that just goes up there. And that is on the Facebook group Awesome Comics Talk, which is great. And thank you for listening to us, as always, whether it was on the website, awesomecomics.podbean.com. If you listen to us on iTunes, subscribe, leave a review, and just generally just get the word out about the show. We love you for it. And thank you for whether it was on the, if you heard us on any of the networks like Spotify, Stitcher, Podnose, Podknife. What are the networks we on, Tony?
We're on the recently rejected character name that I designed for a comic called Marjorie Minge.
Well, we almost made it. We almost made it to the end of the show without him.
What?
Just being you. If only people were privy to that WhatsApp conversation where every time Tony suggested a name, I shook my head and then laughed.
Somebody said, oh, can someone suggest a lady's surname? And everyone went, well, what? And then I obviously suggested Marjorie Minge.
Yeah,
Tony Esmond, Man of the Year. And where can they find you online, Tony?
NeverOnAnything.blogspot.com or SASEZOHYZ.
Nice. Have you got any copies of TWC still available?
Yeah, still loads. I've got about another 50, I think, somewhere.
Where can they get them?
NeverOnAnything.bigcartel.com. You smooth motherfucker, you.
That's what he pays me for. He doesn't pay me. A man who is worth all the money in the world. Dan, where can they find you?
Hey, thanks. You can find me on Twitter at Vanguard Comic, and you can read Vanguard at vanguardcomic.com.
Nice.
I'm also kind of changing myself into a kind of like spiritual guru on Instagram.
This is making me die. This is the best thing ever.
Yeah.
And the best thing is your wife's replies to it.
Yeah.
I'm just a twat.
Yeah.
And I think Cliff Cumber said, don't do my guru down. He's changed lives. And she went, okay, utter twat.
Yeah. One of the beautiful things about Dan Butcher Online is just the subtle, the wit, the sarcasm, just it's absolutely beautiful. And there's two things about this latest thread that he started doing that I find hilarious. A is the images themselves, and if people may actually think he's being serious, that makes me laugh even harder.
Yeah.
And B, the fact that when it comes to your online social media presence, Dan, you can never get too full of yourself, can you? Because your wife bullies you.
Yeah.
It's sublime.
Keeps it real.
Yep. We're a huge fan of Zoe on this show. She's actually mean to me as well, so that doesn't really matter, you know.
She's lovely in real life. On the interweb, she's quite mean.
Yeah. Whereas Dan is who he is, and you should follow him, and also Vanguard's absolutely smashing it at the moment.
Thank you.
So, and you can follow me on social media and Instagram at Jester Diablo, where I'll just be posting anything until I've got a comic to release.
We'll mostly just be messaging each other about how excited we were about today's interview.
Pretty much. And there might. Now that Dan, you inspired me to do some more sort of like those Procreate videos. That was just fun.
They're really easy. I mean, if you're just drawing on it.
Yeah, Procreate, basically the drawing program Procreate, when you're drawing, it records it. So if you do, that's I did that Wolfman sort of.
Oh, that was great, mate. I love that. Yeah, yeah.
Oh, thank you.
I video myself procreating as well. Is that different?
So thank you for listening this week, folks. Yeah, but don't post them on your Instagram, Tony.
Okay, fine. I don't really understand how it works, but I won't. Yeah.
Certainly don't do it on Twitter. They'll kick you off.
Yeah. That's not true. There's a lot of accounts on Twitter which are a bit shady.
Yeah, there are.
Yeah, and if you want to know about them, then email us. Awesome comments. But no, thank you for listening this week, folks. Hope you enjoyed this week's fantastic interview. Stay tuned for next week, because who knows what's coming on this show. But for now, thank you for listening. Go forth, read loads of comics, discover some new comics. Well, it don't actually have to be new comics. Just discover some comics. Yeah.
Read a fucking comic.
Yeah. Let's get that on a t-shirt. Make millions.
Yeah. We'll have to get a new t-shirt at some point.
Well, yeah, that's true.
Yeah.
Emotion in your pants. I've still got a t-shirt for you, Dan, from Cumber. Yeah. Emotion in your pants.
Ah, ace.
Yeah.
Anyway, from Dan, Tony, and myself, have a brilliant week. And as always, what do people do?
Stay awesome.
Oh,
I'm getting into this, aren't I? You can tell.
Yeah, I know. I'm loving it. You're a changed man this year.
Am I? Oh, dear.
Got to keep you unbalanced. That's what I said to Cliff. That's Tony's power. You think he's going sus, and then he changes tack, and you don't know.
Yeah. That's how I'm trying to take pictures of him with a seagull.
Yeah. Oh, God. Anyway, have a lovely week, folks. See ya.
Love you. Bye.